Welcome back to Deep Thoughts, ladies and gentlemen. Tonight I'm coming to you in the later hours because I've been working on a new script project. Very excited about it. I've been talking to my contacts and testing out scene ideas and about to hit the words tomorrow. But today's episode is about something that I am going to entitle The Instant Earth Theory. So let me ask you a question. What if the Earth is fairly brand new, and that most of the history that you've been told that occurred, and most of the artifacts that have been discovered to prove that that history actually occurred, were either remnants of a previous use of this container, or simply put there, that the idea that you are living inside of a movie has a bit of truth to it? So you're probably needing a little more clarification on that. So allow me. Now, I want to make sure that everyone listening is feeling included in this, but one could actually start this theory, say, a day before your birth, what you think is your conscious birth. So let me go back, say, 150 years and say, what if the Earth started in, 1870? That means everyone who's alive today would be well within this envelope, but almost everyone who's ever lived on Earth never really existed. For those of you who are into the flat Earth thing, you can bring your model right into this conversation. Why do we think it's round? Well, because the sun's round, the moon's round, planets I've seen in a telescope are round. So it's pretty obvious that we would think we live on a round thing. There's bubbles in water. So these physical models actually work scientifically, but maybe they're not true. Maybe it's a matrix. Could be a computer matrix. Could just be that this is theater. Could be that we live on a ball, but the ball is so big that our little world is a contact lens on top of that. So we do have this contact lens over us, which is the flat Earth model. And the reason why we do sense a tiny bit of curvature every time we do an experiment, but nothing like the spherical bend of the Coriolis effect that we're told should exist, is not due to refracting light around a corner. It's simply because the space we occupy is a little tiny compartment on top of this much bigger planet. You know that I'm fascinated to death, and some of you are too, with pre-dynastic Egypt discoveries. Basalt boxes that I keep talking about and all this other stuff, the circular saw marks that we absolutely positively see on those stones, boreholes that require at least 6,500 pounds of pressure to bore a hole in 60 seconds, which we have proven with scientific method now, stacking 2.5 million rocks into the Great Pyramid, chambers that go way down into the ground, potentially half a mile into the ground. There's nothing that explains, for instance, where did all the equipment go that built the stones? And if they had steel or some harder substance, some harder alloy with diamond bit drills or something even stronger than diamonds that could cut these stones, we have seen the proof. I will put it in the video as you watch this. As I mention those things, you will see the video or the picture pop up. Basalt boxes that are utterly perfect, that were 100 tons of stone after they were carved out. Mitered to, in some cases, to a thousandth of an inch of perfection. And then polished by hand somehow. Why would there be a society with all this advanced equipment trying to live inside basically Fred Flintstone homes? For any reason whatsoever, why would they build a pyramid that seems to collect ethereal winds with various conductive limestones to then project it down into an aqua ravine with a honeycomb plateau? When you have the power to turn a saw so fast it can cut a level 8 rock a level 8 hardness rock. It makes no sense. The cart is before the horse with any theory that you might come up to explain these things. Well, what if our creators were just experimenting with much smaller subsets? They created a Fred Flintstone world. They just happened to really like the pyramids. They didn't create any phonetic language or iconic language at all. They just put these people out there and to see what would happen. Maybe it was just a little Disneyland resort. Maybe this is a Disneyland resort. Maybe this is a Westworld resort. There's this gentleman we've talked about several times on the show over the course of 5 years. Mr. David Icke, who definitely has some extreme merits in this world. I haven't seen him talk in a really long time. But I know that he advances a theory of reptiles, shape-shifting reptiles all over the world. And he's only doing it through deduction, not through personal experience. And he's very clear about that. But now what if a gigantic portion of this world is some species like that? Let's just say there's, just for the sake of argument, okay, about 8 billion people on this planet. I don't think they really know how many people on this planet. I think the plus or minus would probably be a billion. Well, plus or minus a billion. But whatever, 8 billion. What if 7.9999 billion were these other beings, either similar to those who crafted the world, or perhaps a benign being that was created to not really interfere too much beyond the parameters of whatever experiment we're conducting for them? For those of you who at least went through junior college, like me, and you at least got through sociology, I ended up taking it twice because I went to one college and then couldn't carry my credits to the college, took it again. I love learning, so for me it was like totally cool to hear both things twice. Now, how many people, now I want you to reach into your mind, don't knee-jerk a response unless you absolutely know this was a profound moment for your mind. But how many of you heard that when you're conducting a sociological experiment, and the people that are the subject of the experiment understand that they're being watched, they behave differently. And so it's important that if you're going to really create a good set of result data from your experiment, the people being observed can't know they're being observed. Otherwise, it changes everything. All right. When you heard that, did you get a weird feeling that, oh my God, I'm being watched? Douglas Adams wrote in The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, when Arthur Dent met Slarty Bartfoss and he's learning about the fact that the world was a computer to generate the question to the answer of life, the universe, and everything, which was 42, he says, oh, well, maybe that explains the fact that my entire life I felt like I was being watched. And Slarty Bartfoss quickly snaps at him and says, oh, no, everybody in the universe has that. Well, obviously, a writer named Douglas Adams came up with that idea in a hotel room as he's writing this incredible radio series that turned into a series of books, because it is something that we all think about. I used to dream that I was in a Truman Show when I was a little kid, before that movie was even going to be 20 years, you know, 20 years from its being created. I remember at the age of 9, I used to have these weird visions of, if I left a room, they were breaking down the set behind me. I had a dream once that I walked too quickly into my apartment in Derby, Kansas, walked into the kitchen, and they were eating sandwiches and looking at me like, oh shit, he just saw me. And they quickly jump out of the room and put the walls together, and then I fell asleep, and then I went back out in the room and it was fine. As if they could put me to sleep and reset it and make sure he thinks that was a dream. It never happened again, so I don't have any delusions, thank God. They must have fixed my brain if that happened. But now think about this. Isn't it interesting that if we were so privileged to be able to finance any viewer of this show to come to a centralized location, and we all got to meet each other and shake hands and give each other hugs and just sit down, maybe I start a stogie, and we got a chance to talk, we'd find that we have all these like minds, that we have these deep brains. And we're deep in all different ways, but it's still fascinating to let one person talk, and then the next person talks, and we're all just in heaven, man, because we're all on the same wavelength. I'm just the MC. That's it. But we all meet, and we realize we have the best weekend week at some Club Med, wherever we end up, and then we go home. And wow, the difference of living together for those 7 days or what have you, and having every cell in our body feel like it's turned into a neuron, that we actually lived for those 7 days. From sunup to sundown, we could find a great conversation among all of us. And we all know that we don't believe the same thing. Someone's going to believe very heavily in the Bible, someone's not. But we still respect each other because why? We're intelligent. But we go home and instantaneously we would find people that, again, aren't bad people whatsoever. We still love those other people that we meet when we go back home. Not necessarily our family members, but other friends and, you know, associates and what have you. But there might be a big difference between the quality of conversation and the quality of thought. And then, kind of subliminally, we would probably be feeling some thematic thing like, well, that was my tribe, man. That was my tribe. I was with my people. No matter what we talked about, no matter how mundane or complex, it was enjoyable. Whether we agreed or disagreed, it was tolerable. It was nice. We actually had a means to disagree in a way that we had smiles on our face the entire time. Or we even changed our minds because someone had the ability to talk without being interrupted. And it felt good. I have friends in my life who do this to me. And when I'm done talking to them, and I go anywhere else in this world, as much as I love my other friends and family and what have you, there's no one like these people. It's this instantaneous, intense engagement, whether we're talking about nothing, laughing our heads off, or really getting in deep, telling a touching story that makes either us get verklempt or they're telling us a story and we're getting verklempt, doesn't matter. The whole human condition, the human experience is being fully engaged. Now, in a way, this instant earth thing, I am trying to be as literal as possible. Perhaps there's multiple containers all over the surface of this ball. Again, a ball so big that it feels flat. The container. I mean, when you're inside of let's just say it is a heliocentric earth, but you're inside of a big football stadium. Well, it doesn't feel round because you're so tiny and it's so huge. But you could just keep getting it bigger and bigger and bigger and adjust for gravity. The gravity algorithm works, but it's all based on, you know, false pretenses of where we are and what's going on. But we got to figure it out. That's all we really need. What kills me is the pre-dynastic Egypt thing. That's what's kicked off this episode in my mind. It's really racking my brain, man. So racking my brain. Because the evidence is so painfully right in our face. The cart got before the horse and appeared to function properly. The one way I parse it in my mind is that if machines were built with steel, then they would rot away over the course of 10,000 years. And I happen to believe that pre-dynastic Egypt is at least 35 to 40,000 years ago because of a bunch of other very deep science about that era, the star alignments with the constellations on the ground, a bunch of other things. Then it hit me that even if we were to find these machines, it wouldn't make any sense that they would live in a stone age, literally, with options to create skyscrapers out of that same equipment, flying vehicles. There would only be a fascination with stone, perhaps as an art installation or something. But then again, there probably wouldn't be an abandoned basalt box in the middle of a hallway, because they wouldn't build them inside the hallways in the first place. They build them externally, float them in on some anti-gravity thing or whatever they're doing. But no, there's evidence that never happened either. There's anomalies like Christopher Columbus quote unquote, discovering the Americas. But there's already people here. Okay. Well, obviously somebody discovered it before we did. But then again, we now have human beings on every single plot of land in the entire world, including Hawaii, Easter Island. It's a little bit easier to digest the Indonesian islands because they're so close. You know, you can probably see a lot of them and then you see the next one and you kind of know, just keep going in that direction. You'll find another one. Oh, there's another little one. I can survive on that one. I can't survive on that one. Everyone got eaten by snakes on that one. But Hawaii, go check it on a map. It's far away from everything. Easter Island, same thing. But and yet they still have inhabitants on them. Okay. And then we have different shapes and designs of human beings, different pigment colors in our skin. You have black and white. Then you have different shades of black, different shades of white. Then you have the Asian cultures, the Native American cultures, the Latin American cultures, which, you know, removing the conquistadors, you at least have the Pygmies and the Peruvians and the Incas, the Aztecs, the Mayans, the Aborigines. It seems illogical that somehow everybody swam everywhere. It also seems illogical that you have some groups of people like New Guinea, where you've got the really, really prehistoric man in that has been largely undisturbed, but they get there in the first place? How is it that you would have a society of completely sophisticated beings capable of getting to a particularly remote location and not find Panther City there 20,000 years later? I mean, don't you just stand on the shoulders of the people that brought you there and you just keep going up and your neural net keeps getting denser and denser through inbreeding with your own people? Someone's going to get bored and find an old screwdriver from the ancestors that got there and do something else and figure out how this works. Do smart people really travel around the world on oceans and then not bring all the necessities and information that let them get there in the first place? We got pyramids on every single continent. Isn't it interesting how, and the mudflood people are very into this, but that the further we dig down on these continents, we find stuff, previous civilizations. Now, everybody could say it's just weather anomalies, and there are a lot of solutions to mud theory that way. But no matter how far we dig down in England, we find more civilizations that were there before us. I mean, really, down there deep. Egypt, in Cairo, on the Giza Plateau, four stories down is 360 feet. That's 36 stories in modern-day times. Are they just frosting over a previous experiment? Did they go extinct because of some issue that they overdid something and or warred and killed each other? Or did they absolutely flub the experiment and whoever owns the dome said, all right, yeah, that's pretty cool. I screwed up too, man. Gee, hope we get the next one right. Yep. It's just like Cabin in the Woods, man. There's a reset. But we believe history exists because we're told it exists, right? It's like I mentioned in the Histories of the Matrix episode. It's so true. And if anything, this could be the 101, and History is the Matrix is the 202 to this, or 201, to this particular episode. It's interesting that if I had to prove to you that the world existed before I was born, I don't think I could prove it to you. I could definitely suggest it to you. I could insinuate it to you. I could take what I've been told and pass it to you. But if I had to personally prove that the world exists before me, and what I mean by that is not the world as in the soil and the rocks, but civilization existed before me, the only thing I could probably say is that I think it takes a man and a woman to make me, and so there had to be an inception point prior to my existence to incubate me to birth. I watched my kid grow up in her mom's belly. All right. I've seen it happen to other people. Think about the theory of the dinosaurs. If you start the theory of the dinosaurs in, say, 2021, it seems like a very intense paleontology science that is absolutely bona fide and it totally was real. All these dinosaurs really existed. Once you look up the history of it, you'll realize it's all BS. But the Tyrannosaurus Rex was a fictional being created by a 6-inch tooth found in some river, supposedly. You'll find that the first two guys that invented paleontology had lied so bad that they discovered 136 dinosaur species. And that today, modern paleontologists say, well, they lied about 104 of them. But it's real. It's totally real. And the Tyrannosaurus Rex that was totally fake in, 1865 or so? Well, you know, we actually did discover that thing exactly the way that guy faked that thing in a museum. So now it's real. I will go to my deathbed without some super-duper frozen 400 million year old being found frozen, the point I can touch it and I can see it and I can be there during its autopsy or its scanning or what have you. I probably need to touch it. I need to take a cell sample and look at it in a microscope. I will think that these things never existed and they were simply inserted in time as a scam to raise money that then became such a profit-making business that when they found real prehistoric animals, like a saber-toothed tiger or a woolly mammoth, they just blended those two things together and said, see, one equals the other. But I think it was inserted in time. Now, there was a theory that I think Eric Dubay made an episode on that. That guy's been absolutely absent from reality. If he's anywhere, I don't know where he is in terms of media that we see. He did provide some amazing videos, man. He's a big flat earther. He did videos on telling you where Christmas came from and all that's just historically accurate, but he did a great job on it. But he did a theory that, he did the dinosaurs, which I think he's totally right about. He did one that he said that Egypt, as we know it today, was literally constructed in the 1850s or something, 1800s. Well, the mechanical devices that made Egypt possible as we know it today have still not yet been invented. So to have these masons do it in the 1800s and in a really short order of time, with a lot of people still on the continent fighting wars and all kinds of other things where there's tons of people there, is hard to believe. However, it's been a long time since I've seen that documentary, and since he's had his channel erased 90 times, I don't know if any of that stuff's still up there. He did cross-pollinate some really bad data, because there are pyramids in the world that are very sharp and very steep, and they look like almost cones that you would find at some construction site, although they're pyramids with four sides. And he said, see, that when they first drew the pyramids from Egypt, they look like these, and all of a sudden there are these big fat pyramids, and he confused two different sites. So shame on him. Plus, some scientists are just horrible artists, and they're doing their best. But perhaps what might have led him into that theory is this cart before the horse problem with the tools that made so many of these rocks and these sculptures and these statues in some industrialized form. And he just said, you know what, this has to be built more recently, or at least with technology that matches sort of where we are today. But the world experts that know how to cut stone grimace when they're asked, okay, there's the Great Pyramid. Now, you know how it was before it was, when it was done, it had veneered rock on it. It's got 2.3 to 2.5 million stones. It's 465 feet tall, approximately. It's got chambers inside that reach out to stars. Now, if you're hired to do this thing, what's it going to take? Oh, by the way, it's on a plateau that's actually taller than the pyramid. Oh, it's actually on an aqua ravine. It's got a big catacomb water thing inside and all these hidden chambers underneath. How much was it going to take you to build all that, and how long is it going to take? They're looking at us going, I don't know, a couple thousand years? I don't know. Never done it before. Looks really hard. I understand why people think these other theories have merit. We're starting to notice, and maybe it's just a, I'll give it to you two different ways. There are two explanations of the reference of NPCs in the real world. An NPC, for those of you who don't play video games, the acronym stands for non-player character. When you play a video game, obviously you're real playing the game. Sometimes you'll play games that have other real players in there. There are characters in the game that aren't human. They're there as artificial intelligences. They look like humans because they've been drawn to react. You click on them and they'll give you a quest. They'll say, please go over there, get me that thing and bring it back. And if you do that, I'll give you this sword, which will allow to kill you, that thing over there, blah, blah, blah. NPC. So the two definitions that I recognize on this show is the Project Mockingbird NPC, which is a news anchor who's been bought off by the Black Hats for Project Mockingbird, launched in the 1950s. And remember, in a Senate hearing, and by 1970, they said they were controlling all of the top personalities on news, and that totaled between 750 to 1,000 people. So it's real. And that's the one you'll get in trouble if you post too many memes with these gray-faced characters. They used to block them from you. I don't think they care anymore. Then there's my definition of NPC, which I did an episode on. And it's essentially a fake human. It's either one of two things. We're in a matrix, and these are just AIs that we're talking to. Metaphorically and almost hysterically, we have recreated that within video games. But those are those sort of deer-eyed people you talk to. People you talk to, and they can't seem to muster more than about 500 words in their vocabulary. They're functional in life. They're safe in life. They do their little robotic loops. But they're not actually real people. They don't have souls. They're simply there to fill up the space, to create a simulated environment for the sociological experiment, which is whatever the hell we're in. The secondary theory to that is what I mentioned earlier in the episode, which is that, again, it's Westworld. Westworld, in that particular case, would be a big joke on us, literally the HBO TV series that went three seasons, 2.8 seasons, ended horribly, started brilliantly, ended horribly. And that would be the theory that they're visitors that don't interact too much. But in that particular theory, the NPCs are more like the evil bastards that run the world. It's sort of like when you're young and you're on spring break and you leave, say, Idaho and you go to Fort Lauderdale and you're like, man, I'm going to be a total dick in this world because I don't live here. I'm going home. So I'll break a window, scratch a car, sleep with 10 girls and get them all pregnant. I don't care. I'm going back home. Same thing. They're coming here just like Westworld, the show on TV, where the millionaires went to shoot people, kill people, screw people, everything in the book. And then maybe the totally crazy tongue-in-cheek one is that they're reptilians that are simply here to look at humans that have more emotion because they have an R-factor brain. They're more left brain. But now, what's interesting is this. This is going to screw with some of you. Don't take this too seriously and do anything strange with this information. Now, I think I have parents that are my parents. I do. Kind of look like them. Now, I don't remember being born the day of. Thank God. Might scar me for life. But now, what if my parents were engineered to look like me? And my relatives, they were engineered to look like me too. But they've been crafted to give me the impression that I was born through a womb of a particular person. The reason why your parents, or you end up acting like your parents genetically, is that they are mimicking you. Or maybe just through power of suggestion, we end up acting like them no matter who they are. It's not a genetic trigger. It's not an instinctual trigger. It's just Mother Goose triggering. Isn't it interesting what you can prove to yourself and what you can't prove to yourself? But before anyone says anything, you actually overestimate what you can prove. I can prove that I was birthed out of my mother. Now, we happen to catch my kid my kid's grandmother videotaped her actually being born. So, unfortunately, my child has the video of such a thing. I don't think she has it, thank God, but it was videotaped. And I was there when it happened. A lot of our parents were there. Hopefully our moms were there. But let's subdivide that one more time. just for the sake of being efficient in our theory. What if those of us who are really alive, those of us that would meet as a result of getting together from this show's population, we're real. Our family lines are real. And we're the real ones. Anyone you've ever been able to sustain a long-term relationship with, that's also a real person. But all the robots you see in cars wearing masks by themselves, they're not real. They're there to give you a power of suggestion to test whether or not you actually have a fully developed, say, concept of freedom. And what if the experiment right now is nothing more than to test the resolve of what's inside the petri dish? Okay, hatch the pandemic. Let's watch what happens. We do this every time at this stage in the game. No society as a whole has ever risen up to fight this ridiculous oppression. And when they don't stand up to fight this ridiculous oppression, then they're no longer worthy to live. And poof, you go away. They mud flood the whole joint, replace everything, knock all the buildings down. Hell, for all we know, they can just wait 10,000 years for it to happen. Maybe they just run a little acidic atmosphere in the sky, which melts everything away except stone. So all the tools that made those stones are all long gone. Let it settle for a little while, just like they're baking a cake. Check the radiation levels, check the acidic levels. They adjust the experiment and put a whole bunch of folks in different places this time. Perhaps their aborigines are going to run the world this time. They're going to be the aborigine privilege, and the white people are going to be in South Australia. Or what is it? It's South, North, West, or East Australia, right? Just see what happens. Now, we're all going to find the artifacts of previous civilizations. If we find them in our area, we might make the false assumption that our generation, be it if you're a particular race or what have you, that your generation created that stuff. Remember, the Incas found the pre-Inca stuff, and unlike other areas of the world that try to usurp and steal predecessors that aren't even the same race as them, the Incas were at least honest people. To this day, they're honest. And they say, you know what? That we didn't build that. We call it pre-Inca because we're the people who found it and we're the people who've only lived here as far as we know. So we call it pre-Inca. Some other race. But they don't even make a claim that it was actually their genome that did it. They don't know. And we don't know. It's nice, actually. I will always, always, always praise the Inca people for being truthful about that. And again, maybe it was them, maybe it was their ancestors, but how'd they get so reset from being able to shave the mountaintop of Machu Picchu, getting rid of a mountain off the top of that mountain, creating a flat plateau, and then building that amazing thing up there? But right now we're in this absolute booming cycle of anthropology and archaeology. We're finding new things. And what's really sad about it is that, well, it's actually feeds into this theory. Let me ask you. I come from Kansas, center of the United States. All right. Let's say that I'm digging in the backyard somewhere in Kansas. A farmer is doing some, you know, tilling of some land. Maybe they're trying to put new irrigation in or something. And all of a sudden, ting, ting, ting. We got something down here. Let's keep digging here. That's cool. Oh, wow. There's a stone here that seems to be cut, and wow, it's really flat, except for where I banged it with the saw or the shovel or whatever. And you start digging and start digging, and you start finding a hidden civilization in the center of nowhere. Then you start finding chambers, and there's actually a pyramid down there, but you got to remove so much earth to see the pyramid, and you just keep digging and digging and digging. Let's say we found that. Why the hell wouldn't you quickly prioritize digging out this totally hidden civilization in the ground? And why is it that almost every country that finds such a thing, especially Egypt, okay, they're cock-blocking the entire world from digging out that place? Why? Should be top priority. dig out Egypt, you could charge $1,000 a ticket to come see that place. That country would own the rest of the world if they just get busy with it. But no, everything's shrouded in secret. They're digging out a bunch of chambers under the paws of the Sphinx, and they put this wooden deck out to cover it up when they're not doing it, making you think they're just doing it for your convenience. You don't slip and fall on sand, which is what you put down on the ground to make sure you don't slip and fall on slick wood. The theory is completely upside down. Everyone that tours these folks through those areas, they're always bragging. Yeah, you know, the guy, Brian Forrester, who went down those four stories, 360 feet. They told him, yeah, there's 10 more stories down below. Okay, so it's another 1,000 feet. We're at 1,400 feet. But the Egyptians are the real creators of that place. Created, which is probably some sort of African. Again, look at the statues, probably black folks. Eventually it became the Egyptian bloodline at some point through dozens and dozens of wars and takeovers and all that stuff. But they're always cock-blocking the digs. Always. Why? Well, one, in Egypt, I believe at a fundamental level, they don't want to lose the genetic possession of that land. They don't want to prove to themselves beyond the shadow of a doubt that they didn't actually make any of that stuff, which is why Egypt is not a Panther City. Okay. Whoever built the Great Pyramid, like I've said several times, would have had a Panther City by now, something in a stealth shield, all kinds of flying vehicles. You would, because 35,000 years ago, you were able to build the most amazing things on planet Earth. And what happened to your brains between then and now? How'd you get so much more primitive than these amazing folks that built that place? Because you're not those folks. Plain and simple. But what if there's something else, like instant earth theory, to stop them? What if they just discovered, well, it's pretty easy. Like, let's just say we're two of those folks that built this place, and they're looking down on the sociological experiment. One guy's a newbie. He comes in, he's like, well, I got a question for you. He goes, yeah, what's the question, man? Some old guy. He's already been there a long time. What do you do about all this stuff you leave behind? What do you mean? Well, you left the pyramids behind from the previous experiments. I mean, you got Machu Picchu over there. At least that's what they're calling it. And you got pyramids in China and Turkey and South Africa. And how can you possibly leave the past there for them to discover? And the guy goes, well, you know, it's kind of fun to watch them try to figure out what it is. It kind of stimulates their mind. We get to watch their little experiments. Yeah, but what if they dig the place out and figure out, you know, you got some spaceships down there and some other stuff? Well, you know what? We actually control the folks that own those authority points, and we just deny them. No, they can't dig it out. What if it's just that simple? Stuff sitting right there in plain sight, revealing the reuse of this container. For those studying the mud flood stuff, which if you haven't studied that and you're looking at me like, does he say mud flood? What the hell's that? There's a small, small group of folks that are studying this. And you can see several videos online. Some of them are reaching really hard because, again, there's a theory and then there's things that can look like the theory. Again, I've never done a mud flood episode directly because I haven't found the real linchpin for it. If you think you've got the video and it's something that you follow, please put it in the comments below on YouTube. Or stick it on our Facebook page. But the theory is that the gods do this. They erase civilizations by causing mass floods, just paving over a previous civilization. Now, the problem with the theory is that there's a lot of just basic geology and meteorology that explains probably 95% of what I've seen. For instance, there's some mining towns in America where they happen to build a township on a hill in sort of a valley area, which, you know, protects you against wind if you live inside the valley as opposed to on top of the hill. But as it rains on the hills that don't have foliage to protect this event from occurring, there's no grass, there's no big trees or anything, the water will sink into the hill, muddify it, and over time it slides down into the valley. And if you built a hotel straight up and down with a nice flat foundation, and this continues occurring, and you had a door on the side where the hill goes up, eventually, just over time, the mud's going to build up on that side of the hotel, and they're going to have to, you can't go in that door anymore. You got to build a door on the second floor and get off where the new soil meets the earth, right? Meets the doorway. So that's very natural. But perhaps there is something to it, because we also have these bizarre moments in history where we believe that entire civilizations disappeared in a flash of an eye. Something happened to the pre-dynastic Egyptians on the biggest continent on this planet by a long shot. It's lush at the time. It's got a river with plenty of fish and tropical greenery everywhere. Grain can grow perfectly well. In fact, it does. It grows wild. Plenty of livestock in Africa. There's no overusing the resources in Africa to the point where people are going to starve to death, which is a very common explanation for a lot of things. Easter Island was said to have gone through that they over, you know, pillaged the place. Now, in Easter Island, that theory holds up 100% as a theory. But they also say that crap in South America, where all the Aztec pyramids and Mayan pyramids and Inca stuff, they say they overdid it. Okay, have you seen South America? I mean, outside of a massive pole shift, way more than just the 23 degrees, way more than that. Civilizations seem to vanish from various areas very quickly. And there's no sign of mud flooding necessarily. If so, it definitely greened over very quickly to hide the sort of artifact of such a thing. It's probably safe to say that if you were to go with conventional history, that man has been on this planet way, way longer than they said that we've been here. I just looked at a website the other day that found a steel screw that's probably, you can't quite get the scale from the picture. If I were to guess, it looks like about a 2-inch dowel in thickness with rivets, and it looks like about maybe 6 inches long. Found inside of a stone that is carbon dated 400 million years ago. Okay. Well, hey, if you look at pre-dynastic Egypt, that object actually is definitely further back than we need it to be. But that would suggest that there were machined parts from the past. Perhaps a bolt fell off the dome and sunk into some warm rock or something, and then just got glossed over. I've had this thing on my list to make an episode on, and I don't think I can do an hour on this without boring you guys to death, without doing a tremendous amount of research to try and keep it going for a little bit, you know, at least an hour. But there are all of these artifacts that they have found encapsulated in stones around the world. And regardless of carbon dating is accurate or not, they'll find these things at depths that are just astronomically against the proverbial life cycle, right? Remember, the reason why we know that oil is not a fossil fuel is that oil is found as deep as we can go, but all life stops at 16,000 feet, which just is around, you know, 3 miles. But the Russians have dug, you know, 8 to 9 miles in the ground. There's still oil down there because it's a natural byproduct of the earth. Crushed methane gas turns into crude oil. And then we refine off the carbon to get to the methane, the hydrogen. And we have various octane fuel levels from racing fuel down to kerosene, down to diesel. And it's just the varying amount of carbon atoms in whatever the refining process is in the pipe. What else could instant Earth explain? Remember how I told you about the book that supposedly Plato alluded to, which is... As Plato was growing up as a kid, he claimed that the elders of his time frame spoke of the time before the moon. The moon was a recent addition within the couple generations that he existed. You know, meaning his generation, a couple generations before him, they didn't remember having a white ball in the sky. But they were very mystical people, weren't they? And so having a moon, like if we had two moons tomorrow morning in 2021, holy crap, we'd all go get religious or something. I don't know. But back then, everybody was spiritual. God was controlling the world, or gods were controlling the world, whether or not they were atomistic or pluralistic. They believed that those kind of things occurred. I still think it's astronomically impossible, more so than the operation of a Dominion voting machine, that the moon can eclipse the sun perfectly when, one, the moon's in an elliptical orbit, and two, it's supposed to be arbitrarily in the sky, an average of 237,000 miles away from Earth, and the sun is approximately 93 million miles away, according to modern-day pop science. And yet this object is the same exact size in the sky on occasion to create a full solar eclipse. I think that's impossible. So there's a mechanical reality in those two things working together to create this effect that doesn't make any scientific sense. Plus, our moon is always said to be too big for the Earth. Now, they're trying to tell us the moon will eventually lose orbit with Earth and go fly off on its own space 1999 journey. Really? Interesting. I mean, it gaining an orbital pattern around Earth, meaning increasing its orbital radius from Earth's core, seems utterly ridiculous. Unless we can explain it through ethereal winds. Well, if this is an orchestrated simulation of reality, then everything makes sense. The theory that the moon is a burned-out sun, it simply expired. And on a particular evening, as the sun went dark, which could be blamed on an eclipse back in the old days, imagine seeing the sun flicker out of existence. I mean, who knows how that thing might end? I'm sure those who put it in place would know exactly when it's going to expire. Whether it be a serendipitous moment that's tracked by some device and the little alarm goes off and he's like, oh, what's that? Oh, well, the sun's about to go out. We got to put a new one in. Sun department. Yeah, we need another sun in dome 4563. Okay, we'll have it there. How fast do you need it? 5 minutes. Okay, good. And they just have a policy to let the other one sit up there. Why is the moon white? Why does it lack any composition of Earth? Yet the going theory among pop science addicts is that because the guy created a simulation of a gigantic Earth killer hitting the Earth and spinning out part of its debris into the moon, that's the way we believe the moon was created, which is absolute BS, okay? And the big reason is the moon is so freaking far away that the simulation they always show on TV puts the moon about, 10 feet away from Earth in the simulation. When if you just think of the fact that the Earth is about, let's just say, rounding up, it's about 8,000 miles across diameter-wise, and divide 237 by 8. That's how many times you could put an Earth between the Earth and the moon. The moon's way out there, man. By heliocentric pop science. But if you take a flat Earth model and a simulation model and an instant Earth model in a contact lens, perhaps on a bigger ball, so we see very little curvature when we do all of our laser experiments, thus catalyzing the relative theory of where we are being relatively flat. Can you imagine that? We're a contact lens on another big ball. That means heliocentric people are partially correct, and flat Earth people are partially correct. Was it that Picard guy who took the hot air balloon up, looked at his hot air balloon and said, it looks like a dome with upturned edges. No, a disc with upturned edges is what he saw out the window. Perhaps all of this gets to be like a 5D chess experiment to say, okay, and let's just say we'll go back to that conversation between two guys who are working this place, and they're just like, longshoremen of the dome. But one kid's really green. Yeah, he's heard a little bit about this place, but let's just see, get a job without knowing anything. It's a Hollywood script where I'm using a dumb kid talking to a smart guy so I can exhibition the technology for the audience to hear. And, you know, he knows about his physical composition because he went to grade school. He gets in there at the job and he's like, okay, maybe it's his son talking to a father, making it a little easier. So that way he can get close to, but he won't be qualified to take a job. And he just simply says, Dad, yep, son, what's this whole thing about? Like, what are you guys doing inside this dome with all these people in here? He said, well, son, it's a really deep answer. Best way to describe it is we've got challenges for all different types of people inside this dome. No matter where they are intellectually, no matter where they are physically, both physically as individuals and physically geographically in this experiment, we have challenges for them. And we have computers and individuals that are embedded with them to collect the data, to let us know. And the kid says, well, why do you do it in the first place? I mean, what are you trying to find out? And he says, well, we're trying to find out a bunch of stuff. We have some stuff on a list we're trying to figure out. And we have this whole division that tries to find new things that we've never discovered before to learn about ourselves. That's why they look like us. And the kid says, well, can I go down and play around with them? And then he says, well, only when you get older, because you have to be trained not to reveal what's going on. Because if these people knew we were watching them, it would completely pollute the experiment. And we'd have to kill every single person inside this dome if you reveal what was going on. And until you can understand and appreciate and pass the training where you're tempted by everything in your soul to give up a secret. Until you can be purified of that process, you can't go down there. But I tell you what you can do. Every once in a while, we actually take these vehicles inside. And they're invisible to these people in most cases. What do you mean, most cases? Well, for some reason, some of them can see us and some of them can't. But we take our vehicles down there, and you know what they call us when we're inside those vehicles? What, Dad? They call us UFOs. What's UFO stand for? Unidentified flying object. Wow. We actually got bases in the bottom of their oceans. That's where we go to stage individuals that are actually going to join the population. That way they don't see us necessarily dropping off new resources. Of course, we're always studying the health of the dome itself, making sure the oxygen is good, the water is where it should be. But now imagine we pop out of the conversation. And part of the metrics of this entire thing is to experiment from them to us, which is basically racially, species-wise, all us. They look just like us, let's just say, within reason. Obviously, we would look a little bit different than them because we're making sweet love to each other and they're doing the same outside. But perhaps their whole thing, or not their whole thing, but a big part of it is they experiment with telling us who we are to see how that impacts our perception of ourselves and thus how we end up evolving within this experiment. They practice with the whole simulation where there's a God. It's embedded into the religions, perhaps even Jesus Christ and every other deity of virgin birth, death, and resurrection, like Jesus, the 27 or so versions of him that have been told in different times and different religions and different species, races. They're all real. Those things really occurred. This dude was real. Why was he able to do all the experiments and, miracles and things that he did? Because he came with equipment that could do that. Or he understood perhaps some greater truth of the universe that is all powerful. Remember when you read in the Bible that says, you know, a person with infinite faith can move a mountain just by willing it to do so. Perhaps that individual is one of them, our true, uninhibited, unmanipulated, unrestricted self with pure history and not faux history is able to do such a thing. Or perhaps like the Star Trek episode, I think with, I think it was Next Generation, where they had that thing where someone was pretending to be a deity and it was terrorizing these people. And they uncovered that it was an alien using a bunch of equipment from a stealth ship in orbit. But the point is, every once in a while, the gods come down. They experimented with that. The leftover history is where we get our religion. But as more mechanical devices came into play to record history more accurately, like the printing press, eventually cameras, they don't do it anymore because it would be then deduced and figured out that of where we are. For now, it's safe because it turns into a fable. It turns into a fictitious thing for a lot of us. We still get the message. We still get the truth and the beauty of these religions. But we don't necessarily know if we believe it or not because we don't want to be disingenuous to ourselves and especially a creator if we happen to be face to face at one point in time. They're studying perhaps those of us that figure that exact thing out and those that never figure it out. And there's benefits to both. The rapper Hobson, I think it's his Hobson 7, where he's walking in the desert and he's having a conversation with God. It's one of the most touching, most powerful rap songs, I guess you could call it that. It's amazing. It's more than that. That's why the only reason why I say it that way. He's arguing with God a little bit and he's saying, you know, you gave me a brain. And this brain that you gave me makes me think this is all fake. And if it's all fake, then what the hell am I doing on earth? And at one point in the middle of the song, he says, I'm fucking done. I'm fucking done with this bullshit. You need to come down here and straighten this out from my brain. I'm tired of this mess. You've let the devil run the world. And everyone's lying to me constantly, so how can I possibly take this religion into my heart? Because he did at one point. That's the first part of the rap. He took it all into his heart. He believed it all. He took a hit on the chin for being religious with his rapper buddies. He got persecuted. And then he, through his own intellect and through his own research and deduction and connections, decided, Jesus, this is probably fake too. Because nothing in this world is real. I mean, no truths really exist except the ones we hold in our hearts. 5D chess. 5D chess, man. Something for everyone, no matter how developed you are. There's something to challenge you, something to reward you, something to inspire you. There's failure and success at all levels of wealth, all levels of spirituality. You will always end your life empty to some extent because there's always something that you wish you had done that you never did, something you did wrong that you can't right, which equals regret. But it makes you who you are. And a lot of folks at the end of their life will say, you know what? I didn't do everything right. I didn't get everything experienced that I could have experienced. I wasn't as dedicated to things I wanted that I should have been, but I wouldn't change a thing. And why? Because in the end, they actually ended up loving themselves. They ended up loving their lives. They ended up loving every person they met, and they realized that if they had changed the price of tea in China, they wouldn't have met somebody that was very important to them. It's all being observed. It's all being networked. Now, I don't think any of this, not that this really matters in this particular conversation, but I don't think any of this really negates a God by any means or a spiritual world or what dreams might be, which is a playground of the spiritual world that we get gifted with every day. That still might be a mystery for those on the outside. Or maybe it's not even a mystery. Maybe like, oh yeah, well, God exists for sure. It's nothing that they think on average. Some of them figure it out. But then they turn into Hobson in the desert, tortured by their lucidity. The fact is, in this world, and I bet many of you know, and I've said it a dozen times on different shows, but the more intelligent you get, the more inquisitive you get, the more isolated you get when you try to reach out and share your experiences and thus grow your connections and grow what you understand about the world. And let's just say, again, we'll go to the Trivial Pursuit game piece, the board game, right? It's the pie with, I believe, at least 6 slices in it, right? 6 categories of questions you'll be asked. Well, you take one of them and you research that thing to death. At the same exact time, in a different place on Earth, someone else that you're going to meet does another pie slice. And let's say there's not too many pie slices, but there's more than 6 for sure. But if we could just bring, let's say there's 20 pieces, 20 key core categories of being alive, of making connections. If you could bring all 20 people together in a Deep Thoughts University, go see the store on deepthoughtsradio.com, we would have the whole perspective of the entire universe as it exists for us. And with those 20 pieces connected, there's an epiphany of utter consciousness. It's almost like the old story of the Native Americans that could not see the boats coming in from Europe because they could not conceive of what a boat was. The shaman, though, the more enlightened of them all, who had taken tremendous amounts of ayahuasca, peyote, and other hallucinogens, they could see it because their minds were open to abstract sight, because they had seen Mother Ayahuasca. They had seen kaleidoscopes swimming in the sky in broad daylight. And so the boat wasn't hard for them to see. And the way that the fabled story goes is that the shaman would tell the people right there, you see that thing? It's shaped like this. It's shaped like that. It's shaped like this. And all of a sudden, the consciousness of an average Native American, which would be an average version of us, went, oh yeah, I see it. I didn't see it before. And then, as they continued to visit the Americas, everyone eventually could see the boat before it landed. So instead of appearing like gods out of nowhere, when they disembarked, everyone was like waving at them before they landed. All right. What if that's the way we see UFOs? As Douglas Adams alluded to in his 3rd book, Ford Prefect parks the spaceship right next to the bleachers at a soccer game / football game for Europeans. And he goes and picks up Arthur Dent. And he says, well, where'd you put the ship? And he goes, right there. And he goes, oh my God, you put that thing in plain sight. How come no one sees it? And he goes, because they can't conceive of it, so they don't see it. Brilliant. Utterly freaking brilliant. What if UFOs are flying everywhere, all the time? And the only people that even have the inclination to point a camera at one or say they've seen one are the folks that can, for whatever reason, through their serendipitous experiences in life, can see it. They're the modern-day shamans. There's a real... I'm reading one of Graham Hancock's book on this sort of ayahuasca experiences. My close friend Carla's actually had them. The question is are you seeing something inside your mind's eye that is being chemically created in your mind? Or are you seeing a real entity that just simply exists around us and is simply unlocked by the drug combination to get your brain to fire in a particular way that kisses your soul in such a level of detail that you can see her? And I'm going to tell you, I think it's the latter. And why is that? Because Mother Ayahuasca has a name. If someone claims to have the true hallucination experience by taking this substance, they all see her. Some of them see her fairly identically, and some of them see her differently. First time I dropped acid and sat in the backyard, my buddy Richard, you know, I said this story several times. He points up at the sky and he goes, what do you see? And I see the sacred geometry symbol of life in the frickin' sky. And he goes, I see the same exact thing. We even drew it. Yeah, you see that? Yep. Concentric circles inside of each other. we were seeing the same hallucination. Ain't that interesting? Now, of course, someone could biologically explain that perhaps by saying that the cellular structure of the visual cortex, of which we only use 5%, and is limited to 5% by a genetic blocker, a protein blocker, that prohibits our data coming in from our eyes from crossing over 4.5 slices of our visual cortex. I guess it's 10%, right? There seems to be a reason why we have been engineered not to see most of the light that we ingest. Now, it could be way more complicated than this in terms of our existence. I'm just going to throw a funny one at you. Some people say they see Bigfoots. And imagine that, and people have suggested that Bigfoots actually live in a different dimension and only sometimes cross over into our dimension. It's always in the middle of the Ozarks or something, right? Never just happens in, other than the Beastie Boy video for Triple Trouble, which everyone needs to see, they don't end up in downtown New York. Interesting. And that could be, well, actually it doesn't make any sense at all. Obviously, in one dimension, New York could be a forest. In the other dimension, it could be a concrete jungle. But let me just throw this at you as a silly example of a bigger concept that might indeed be true. Those who take DMT say that they run into gray aliens and you get assigned a gray alien. And every time you take DMT, the same gray alien will escort you around that other dimension. But that they can show up in the room. I read a book on DMT, the dream molecule, and it said that people would, I think it was a woman, that she said she did it in a living room, and all of a sudden the room was full of grays. But not like feral grays, but really civilized, living in this same environment that she was in, and that she got the distinct sort of disdain of perhaps like aristocratic scumbags that are like, get that scumbag out of here, they shouldn't be here. You know, they were like, get out of here, you know, because she shouldn't be in our dimension. Like angry, like this happens every day. But what if a Bigfoot is simply an object, a being that's living in some wild, literally in the wild place where perhaps because of their consciousness, perhaps because of a mechanism, some sort of thing that we're doing in our world, like some impulse of energy that wiggles him into existence. He's there, you see him, you see her, whatever it is. And then they manage to get pulled out by the dome owners. Oh, crap. This one's crossed over. Get them out of there. Okay, great. And so you can't find them, but they do make footprints on the ground. People simulate it after they see it because they want evidence and proof. They don't have any, let's just say. So they fake it on the ground to get the story to go. But the 1967 footage of the female supposedly looks fake as hell to me. But, you know, what if it's real? This would be a fun way to explain it, wouldn't it? Now, I'm going to go back to Earth. And let me suggest a couple things. Now, again, most of us are absolutely, positively mystified by the fact that every single human, or as Quark would say, human, who seems to run this place, whoever becomes a president, a chancellor, or a prime minister, and all of their subjects are all evil, crazy people that do all kinds of disgusting rituals, that treat us like meat, that treat us like toys, our children like toys. Why are they always unanimously that way? I mean, the big boys, there's a lot of folks underneath that are okay. But why are they always douchebags that don't seem to care about humanity whatsoever? I mean, you never find a good leader, as far as I'm concerned, anywhere in the world. I'm sure they're out there, but, you know, why are they so rare, like Bigfoot? Well, those could be our visitors, who, again, are living at a Westworld thing. They want to engage in all their perverse fantasies in our world. They destroy our children because they don't care. It's not even just an R factor scientist who's like, of course I experiment on you. I must learn this, right? It's not like that at all. It's a gunslinging brothel. They do anything they want. There's no reset for us. We just simply die. And, you know, our soul goes and does its thing. Hopefully they can't control our souls. Oh, my God, could you imagine? Oof. You'd be trapped in this prison planet. Holy shit, that'd be bad. And then there's the other tier, which is your more quiet folks that may be in control. The only time they interact with us is when they need to nudge us this way, nudge us that way. But perhaps they don't do much at all. Yeah, they make sure the guests don't get too crazy. Because again, compared to Westworld, if this was the case, this is more like paintball. You go into paintball and if you get shot once and they hit you and the ref goes, yep, you're hit, get out. You got to hold up your hand, I'm out, you know, no one shoots you anymore. And you walk to the edge of the game and you have to wait till the game's over to go back in again. Sort of a birth, death, resurrection thing, right? So you can't have in our world some crazy nut that pushes the button and launches a nuclear war and kills the whole dome off. That's not allowed. Let's say someone actually achieved that level of power and wanted to do that. And so the dome owner's got to come in and spank some guests out of their annual pass, let's just put it that way. I think that the more that you study the world, and again, you bump up against these pre-dynastic rocks in Egypt, these stones that have been cut to a level of precision that today's engineers would literally cry if they were forced to make this thing accurate. Otherwise, they were going to die. Their family was going to get slaughtered because they know they can't do it. But they know in their heart of hearts that supposedly a civilization 30, 40, 50,000 years ago did do it. And they're like, well, Christ, well, how the hell do these people do it? And I can't do it with modern equipment. Once you start seeing those things, there's just an impossibility that you start feeling. Well, how's that even possible? How is it possible that all these rocks exist that prove a whole slew of historical evolution in engineering, right? Think about it. How, let's just subtract the pre-dynastic knowledge and say, when was the first diamond bit circular saw ever used in human history? I don't know the answer to that. When's the first time someone could bore a hole in a level 8 piece of granite or limestone 12 inches down inside of a rock in less than 60 seconds? When was the first time we ever did that in modern day history? Well, then how the hell was, you know, let's just say, for instance, it was 1950 or something like that. We're pretty sure that this technology ceased to exist about the time the pre-dynastic era ended, which would have been potentially, again, 30 to 40 to 50,000 years ago. And so we're talking about another 30 to 40,000 years that must take place before the first circular saw exists that can cut a level 8 rock. So you take pre-dynastic rock, let's just say we can finally say, you know, we can't because they protect this information, keep telling you everything's 3200 BC or whatever. Let's say we know that this thing was created in 35,000 BC or more. Then we have to dial back another 50,000 years, roughly, to get to enough time for man to evolve up naturally to find out this equipment. And for some reason, the equipment's gone. And for some reason, a society that seemed to have the ability to create stone to look just like humans, just like lions, just like Jekylls with rib cages and everything. They lacked the ability to transcribe in language either relief in a rock or a papyri or a painting on a wall, any of these other devices that made their world possible. And again, they chose to live literally in a Stone Age. Not the typical Neanderthal Stone Age, but building all of their homes, temples, hospitals, power plants, tombs, the mastabas, all out of stone. They like big stone too. It's crazy. What's nuts about it is that when you see the size of some of the stones that they carved on average to create not only giant stones within the pyramids, but the stones that create these caverns in the ground, they're much bigger than the stones that were in the pyramid. And there's plenty of other locations I've shared with you that have 100-ton rocks. But the doorways are still for about a 6-foot person, on average. Okay. Why so big, bro? What was your goal there, man? Do you have stone envy from some other civilization? Was it a presence attack on anyone that came to visit you? Why so big, man? And why dig into the ground in the first place? Was it because it was naturally friendly in terms of temperature? Say it was cooler in the summertime? Because in the equator, again, I don't think the pyramids were ever covered with snow. It just doesn't happen in the location of the earth. Tilt or no tilt. And whether or not you believe that the poles have actually done violent switches where, again, what was that? The 1392 map shows the Antarctica as a continent without any snow on it. Okay. Well, that would suggest that man existed at that point in time. And that things did perhaps snow in Egypt. I just think that regardless of what you believe, no one built pyramids in the middle of the snow. So if it was covered with snow and ice and icebergs and all that kind of stuff, then they simply didn't build there at that time. And regardless of how massive and formidable those pyramids are, a glacier could knock those things over in 2 seconds, right? We got glaciers that are miles thick, man. It would literally crush those rocks down to sand. Well, they seem to be fine, don't they? There's the theory of the ice ages, which I dislike very, very much. In their totality of their theory, to be wiping off the entire planet. So instead of mud floods, it's like ice floods, you know, or whatever. I think that's a convenient way to install an intellectual barrier from reaching beyond the ice ages to discover anything. Man will say ice age, and it's just like saying some sort of thought police thing to say, you're not to think beyond this point. But what if that narrative is simply inserted by the dome owners to create such a mental frailty in man? And folks like us who think past those things, we literally say that didn't happen to that extent. Sure, yeah. Glaciers exist today, and glaciers roll rocks, and we see the similar rocks in different places on Earth. So we always attribute it to ice as if no other methodology could use it. And to the extent that these rocks couldn't be moved around by other means to give an illusion, those rocks that we blame on ice ages could be created billions of years ago and simply be right there. And then you misinterpret them and associate them with other rocks that were more recently created to create a single theory that the whole world was rolled over by glaciers, all the way down to Egypt, of course. Absurd theories, in my opinion. We're so quick to jump onto answers for mystery questions. And then we lock them down because we don't want to think anymore. That's painful thinking, painful thought process. I forgot who said it, but it might have been someone like a Steve Jobs or someone. But they said, you know, that the amount of frontiers in technology had really come to a very intense point at one point where we know there's more, well, we know technically speaking, there's infinite frontiers for technological discoveries and advancements, but we also know that there's Moore's Law where we have limitations to how far we can take any one invention and exponentially improve it before we run into a threshold where mere mass of the universe and energy organization universe will limit us from going any further without massive advancements in all the technology that moves electrons or other things, right? And I got a little discouraged by that because once someone tells you that there's a limit and you believe it, which at the time I did, you tend to kind of give up on trying within those regions because you're accepting another man's fatigue as your own inspiration. You don't want to do that. You want to stay alive, stay vigilant. You want to be like Jack Parsons, who wants to go into outer space at a time when no one had ever left the atmosphere. right? 1914, the dude's born. The Wright brothers were doing a little bit. Planes were getting up there, but man, we were nowhere close to leaving lit atmosphere. We were nowhere close to getting to an unoxygenated level of atmosphere altitude. But he still figured out a way to do it because he wasn't going to give up. Now, we don't need his Satan worshiping in our life, but shy of that, let's just use our human minds and get creative. I think there are an infinite amount of frontiers to conceptualize so many of the unanswered questions that we have simply accepted, so many limitations that we adopt. You know, equations like E equals MC squared is utter poison for the mind. It tells you that you can't go faster than the speed of light. Well, boy, if you believe that, then don't even try. It's like the patent office telling the Wright brothers that you can't fly, so we're not giving you the patent. What do I always tell you guys? Whatever you practice is what you're good at. Period. That's why a lot of perversion starts in this world. So make sure you police what you practice. Ingesting a bunch of propaganda makes you really a serf to the propaganda. You become a Stockholm syndrome to the propaganda. And I know that we're in an age where propaganda is mostly political, but many people who watch this show religiously understand that it is in every corner of reality. They're always trying to shut down your mind. And part of it starts when you're a child because your parents believe that you don't have the intellectual capacity to conceive of anything complex. And so they satiate you. A lot of parents don't know the answers to things because they're still unknowns to the entire universe. But instead of imbuing a child with the notion of, well, you know what? We really don't know, but maybe that's something that you could go find out. And the kid's like 7 years old going, okay, dad, give me the books. All right, son, daughter, do it. I'll help you. I'll help you find as much as I can. And maybe we'll just go find some people that are current experts at this that have open minds. And we'll ask them the very magical question, which is, well, if we wanted to advance the theory of potentially moving mass faster than the speed of light, where might you go? If someone gives us a good answer, we'll follow that path. If they give us the cliche answer, we'll just put a little X over their name on the sheet and say, of no help to our future endeavors. So the final question, which I have proposed in different episodes from time to time, but not for several years, is the following. What if we prove we're inside this instant Earth experiment? A flat Earth, which is simply a petri dish on top of a bigger round ball. Or whatever. What if we discover that they exist and we prove it and we teach the rest of the world that that's the case, revealing the proof? Maybe it's some experiment someone could do in their kitchen. Maybe it's something they do on a Saturday afternoon looking at the sun. Who knows? There's something that reveals that it's there, that we're indeed inside of an experiment. Then what happens? Do they come get us? Do they come get us? Do they kill us all? What happens? Are we graduated out of the dome individually? Or they come and get us and say, okay, dude, that was pretty good. You figured this out. All right, well, don't fuck it up for everybody here. We're spending trillions of dollars on this whole thing or monetary units of our kind or whatever. Putting a lot of time in this. You get to leave. You got to leave. You got to go. And then you have some mysterious death or something or you vanish. You know, there's been so many people that, said they left notes behind and they told their families that they were going to get on a spaceship and take off. And a lot of the profiles of these individuals are, they were ingenious people. Maybe they figured it out. Maybe they're simply selected. Maybe a bunch of the alien visits that we have where people get probed and all this other stuff where supposedly are, DNA is stolen to make babies. Well, maybe they're trying to figure out where we are genetically. They just come get a little bit of sample from us. Don't know. It's interesting though, isn't it? Hopefully this was a fun little experiment for your mind. And hopefully you saw that there are potentially a limitless amount of branches that come off this theory, regardless if they actually associate with my my overhanging assertion that this might be an instant Earth creation relative to our timeline. It'd be interesting to find a moment in history where all the stars aligned, where we could actually sense that it was a logical point where this could have all started. What would that mean? Well, just a point where perhaps society isn't littered with Magellans crossing oceans. Perhaps where evolution, as far as man's concerned, seemed to flatline, meaning it was a good point to start. Be a fun movie, wouldn't it? Be a lot of work, man. But it'd be fun in the end if you could pull it off. Someone mysterious, you know, someone senses all this data and he's living a torture life and he's torturing his family with it, like Close Encounters, and then eventually he finds it. He finds the wall to the dome or whatever, and it's nothing like he thought. He sails to Antarctica instead of being a cold ice barrier, which is what you and I believe is down there, because a lot of folks haven't been there. Actually, had the chance to pass messages to a guy that actually flew over one of the edges, and my good friend Nicole actually did a tour down there as a geologist. But perhaps they took her somewhere else, you know? Who knows? But they find it and they get out. And I think that would be actually a great act one instead of the final act of the film. And then the movie is them being on the other side. And if you had the guts to write that, then you'd probably sell your script pretty fast. And then for whatever reason at the end, they want to go back in because they realize they don't belong on the outside. So they engage in some highly experimental mental reconditioning so they don't remember being on the outside. And they no longer lust for that vision of the outside. You imagine that? What if you had a fantasy of being in some simulation of your own? You get a copy of the universe, and you think that's what you want. And you get into that world, and for maybe even a few hundred years, maybe even 1,000 years, you have a really good time. But eventually you realize that living in God mode, where you get to control everything, it's your little instance of the universe, not hurting anybody. But you realize it's fruitless. Like the Twilight Zone about mind over matter. You put it all back the way it was. Because that is truly the divine formula. And you realize and appreciate, like so many kids who want to rebel against their parents until a certain age, when they realize their parents actually do know something. And they go back for advice. They go back for help. Same thing. They go back inside the dome. Recondition not to lust for that ever again. That would be one of the experiment finales, which is to say, okay, I'm never going back in here because I figured it out. But it's important that when I go back in to the real universe, that at no point do I have that thought. You become the host inside Westworld. That doesn't look like anything to me. And you love the minutia of the universe. It's rewarding and wonderful. The simplicity of the formula is the brilliant part of the formula. Food for thought. Anyway, hope you enjoyed the episode. And if you haven't been to Deep Thoughts Radio, please go. It's got everything you need. And in this time of limited speech, before we take it all back, please bookmark the website because we're on different sources. The one that's totally independent and totally functional is bitchute.com. That's BITCHUTE. Please go over there and make an account and subscribe to the channel. That way you've got a backup always ready for you. It's not the most functional thing in that there's not an app for your TV. I don't know if you can simulcast it to your TV. I haven't tried that at home yet. But at least to give you a source. And plus there's always the podcast if you need that. But there's everything you need up there. Social media. There's an all-new remastered season one. There's a store. There's a Patreon account if you want to support me. Appreciate all of you who do. In the meantime, take care of yourself and someone else, and I'll see you in the next Deep Thoughts. Over and out.